Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Ryan Edwards is the CEO and founder of Audioo, the music technology company revolutionizing performance royalties through accurate data collection. Founded in 2018, Audioo aims to create a simple and smart tech solution to tackle the issue of inaccurate music royalty distribution. Audioo's audio meter tracks music plays across public locations with pioneering levels of accuracy. Using real-time data, Audioo is helping performing rights organizations and collective management organizations to digitalize and streamline their processes. Ryan has grown Audioo into an international business with employees spanning the UK, Europe, Asia Pacific, and Africa. With audio meters now in more than 15 countries across four continents, Audioo has even attracted investment from music icon Sir Elton John and Bjorn Elvers. Prior to starting Audioo, Ryan formed an extensive background in digital and data, working as head of digital and head of sales for companies such as Visa and Bink. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Audioo CEO Ryan Edwards.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Very good, thanks. So I'm in London. I'm actually at home today. So I live in Wimbledon, just on the outskirts. But our office, HQ, is Covent Garden, so really central London.
I was reading your bio and you previously worked at Visa in different sort of aspects or different industries, so to speak. What brought you and what attracted you there now to go into the world of music?
For me, it's really kind of a full circle life story. So grew up obsessed with music. My dad's a record collector. You know, I probably didn't appreciate the time, but God, the education of soul and Motown records that he instilled into us. And it's funny because even now when I hear an old Motown record, I'm like, oh, that's that. People are like, wow, that's a really eclectic knowledge. And I'm like, I know. And I said, my dad was desperate for me to play the saxophone. He just wanted me to be this like saxophonist. And of course,
A pause there. Why saxophone compared to any other instrument? Because that's an unusual one.
It is. I think he just loved the sound. I think it was just an instrument and a sound that he loved. Yeah. So, I think I started clarinet lessons at the age of 8 because that's a typical way to kind of transition the sax. And actually what we realized as I was hitting my teens is, you know, most sax players are quite big guys. I'm like 5'6" and a bit. So, you know, never really got up and kind of got that. And then also as that's happening, teenage angst kicks in, and you know, no teenager wants to play the saxophone, right? You want to play the guitar, you want to play the drums, you want to impress the girl. That's the reality. So progressed really quickly to the drums, much to I think my dad's upset at the time, but he's definitely forgiven me now, kind of 25 years later. But it's all good. And just fell in love with the era that I was growing up with. I think like most of us, you know, we grew up, you know, the music that we end up with is the music of our youth, right? So for me, it was, I always think it was particularly good because, you know, 15, 16 year old lads are typically quite angry at the world because you just are. And that was, you know, bands like Limp Bizkit, it was Blink 182, it was Green Day, it was like bands that would swear, but had kind of a message and you really got it. And I just loved that kind of pop punk era, indie kind of rock and roll, which of course then all really inherently stems from the Beatles and yeah, the greatest bands around, that kind of era and what was happening. So as you do, you join bands, you gig locally and this, that, and the other. And then at 19 years old, signed a record deal. So drummer in a band. We toured a bit. We went across Europe. We went stateside. And then, like so many, dropped overnight. So, you know, kind of had a UK top 10 single and then boom, all gone. So at this point, I'm like, you know, early 20s going, oh my life, what do I do? Like, how do I figure out my entire life? You know, like, I think like most of us, you know, in that stage of life, you kind of fall into your career, you know? So, you know, unless you grow up going, I'm going to be a doctor or I'm going to be this, right? Many people at, you know, 25 can be like, hey, well, at 15, I had this exact plan and do that. And I basically spent then the next 15, 16 years in digital, fintech retail services. So that was what I was doing at Visa, been an app development business where we were developing apps for both banks, but retail businesses as well, some sports stuff in there. And then about 6-7 years ago, I'm walking through one of the major department stores in London, and I'm with my wife, and we hear my band song playing. And of course, she turns to me and she's like, oh, like, how much are you being paid today? I'm like, it's not going to pay for the Prada handbag. Like, forget it. I'm like, it's probably not going to cover a coffee. Like, forget it. It's not going to happen. And then, of course, it just sparks this whole conversation. My wife's an accountant. So she's going, well, you know, how do you know? How does it flow? What's happening? And she's asking me all these questions. And I'm going, honestly, like, I get like a check once or twice a year. It barely buys a coffee. Just honestly forget it. I don't think our band's going to suddenly re-blow up. Even if there's a reunion tour, we're not going to sell, you know, barely 100 tickets a night. So just calm, be calm. You know, and then of course, a few months later, I get my check through, and I'm kind of going, there's no correlation. Like, how do I know where it was and wasn't played? And just intriguing. So that just leads me to one evening, you know, sat on the sofa watching whatever Netflix series we're watching at the time, to just like opening my laptop and being like, how do they know that I was played in that? And then it was almost like in opening Pandora's box. What I found was just articles and forums and just so much information of, it's all guesswork. It's all surveyed. If you're there during the survey and you get it, you can be really well paid. If you're not, then it's just not happening. The whole system is kind of inequality, and there's just so many things that need to do. So I kind of went on this mission then of kind of a learning and finding out what was going on. And then it was like, well, how do I apply tech? You know, I spent 15, 16 years in tech, built some pretty cool tech for some, you know, great companies. You know, I did the FIFA World Cup app in 2014 for, you know, the Brazil World Cup. We had 1 billion people in it at one point during the final. You know, I was like, okay, you know, how do we do this, and how do we put it together? So built a small prototype at the kitchen table, as you do. And then I've reached out to the chairman of PRS, which is the rights organization here in the UK. And you know, I said this so many times, like, genuinely, I went to meet him to give him the tech. You know, I wasn't looking for a job. I wasn't looking to start a company. I was going to be like, hey, like, I built this. I thought it'd be really useful for it. I'm sure you've got a big team. Like, just have it. Like, it's totally yours. Like, I don't want anything for it. I just thought it would help. And what was supposed to be like a 20, 30 minute meeting ended up being two and a half hours. He was like, everybody's going to need this. Let me connect you with the team. They can't build it because, you know, they're a collection organization. So they don't typically build tech. They buy tech in, or they license tech or this. And he's like, look, let me, you know, he's hanging, let me connect with these. And he's like, and then you should talk to these guys in Ireland and these guys in Germany. And I'm going, whoa, like, just, I don't even have a company name, right? I'm like bringing you some code and a bit of a demo to go, look, I just think this would be useful. And of course, then go home, talk to some friends. I'm like, hey, I just had this reaction, wasn't it? And then before you know it, they're Googling, they're coming to exactly the same conclusions as I am, like, exactly. And so we're like, man, you got to do this. You've just, this has to happen, right? And that was kind of it. And, you know, here we are 6 years later. So, you know, I should say at the moment I was making that decision, we had picked up a puppy, I think 2 weeks before. And then 4 weeks later, my wife was like, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. So, you know, in the space of 8 weeks of the summer of 2018, yeah, puppy, business, and first child, where we realized what all happened. But for me, it brought the focus of a lifetime, right? Because it was like, okay, you just kind of decided to quit your job. You just decided to go it alone and do all of this stuff and go for it. Okay, now knuckle down. Now really, really focus and kind of build. And I think there may be one line of that original code left in the code base now. I think our CTO just has pity on me. He's like, I've left it in there so you feel like you got something in there. But you know, got talent that he was just on a completely different level. I mean, I look at our code now and I'm like, it might as well be like 16th century Mandarin. It is on such a level what the guys do day to day. It's insane. So, yeah.
Okay. So what exactly does the code do?
So I tell you, I put it's kind of three key things, and I should hold one up to camera. I've got one just here. The first bit is our beautiful hardware called the audio meter. This is the US version here. And you can see the holes on it. Little side note is it's designed to look like a vinyl, a little bit of an ode to my dad. So yeah, you can probably just about see the grooves as I hold it up on my laptop camera. Mm. This audio meter goes into venues that are playing music. So any and everywhere around the world, if you own a cafe, a retail, a unit, a bar, a, I don't know, gym, bowling alley, whatever, to have the right to broadcast music, you need a license. So you can't just have Spotify or Apple Music or Deezer, a DSP is your choice. You have to pay a broadcast, what's known generally known as a public performance or a general licensing license.
Yes.
So this goes into those licenses, and the rights organizations that we're paired with essentially give this as part of their terms. So we've sold to the rights organization. They go, hey, you own this cafe, you now get one of these. And I always kind of joke, think about it like an electricity meter or water or gas. Like it's, you have it piped in, and you know, we need to know what's being consumed. So this is the hardware element. We've then got a huge cloud infrastructure with about 150 million songs and even more metadata that sits behind those songs. So kind of the codes that sit behind every song to, kind of the rights holders, you know, where it originated from, all that kind of stuff. So we've got this huge cloud platform of the recordings, the metadata, and then kind of beautiful dashboards. So you can really go through and interrogate and kind of go, hey, where was the last place I was played in the world? Or, you know, why am I trending in this country, but not this country? What's happening? Or my new release is out. How's that tracking versus my last release, etc. And then of course the final bit, which is the really smart bit, of course, is kind of our algorithms and our tech, which is how we do our recognition. So one of the things that my time at Visa taught me, you know, was kind of privacy, compliance, you know, always be secure. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to one major retailer during my time at Visa, and they said, oh yeah, well, we can just store the card numbers. And I was like, why on earth would you want to store card numbers? You know, like leave that on Visa in the bank. Don't be the guys that try and do that. So we've kind of gone with this privacy first approach, which means that when we're in the bar, the gym, the retail unit, we actually do all of our fingerprinting. So that's taking that audio on device in real time. So we never record or transmit audio. It's essentially happening all the time. It cleans it up as it goes, takes all that background noise out and does it that way. And it's kind of we're part of a first that have ever done it that way. Most of these technologies will take a recording or send it to the cloud, and then the latency will all go on the cloud. We kind of wanted to go, no, like we just don't want the conversation. But like, you know, why would you want to store a Visa card number? You wouldn't. So, you know, why would you want to record somebody's audio and be accused of something? You just don't. So that's kind of the three key bits of our technology. And we're applying it in different ways now. So of course we've started with public performance. And then over the last year, we've had more and more people come to us, be it rights organizations, major kind of touring artists, and said, hey, I'm going on tour and I have to submit this set list every night. Can I take your audio meter with me? And you were like, yeah, cool. Like, so we give it to their sound engineer. They plug it into the desk because it gives us a cleaner feed. Because why would you not do it with the best source of audio? And we kind of have live recognition. We have electronic music recognition. So kind of DJs where they're pitch shifting. And it's quite interesting because it's fundamentally changing some of the way that royalties are going to be distributed. Because, you know, like when you go from samples, which is somebody stood there with a clipboard writing down going, hey, it was this, to having a DJ set where they may drop in a sample 40, 50 times of a 2-second clip because it's kind of cool, then actually we can report all of those intervals and kind of how it played into a wider kind of performance, which is super cool.
When you collaborating with artists for tours, can you explain how it works in that scenario?
Yeah. So you've got a touring artist, say, doing 7 countries, right? At the end of every evening, the end of every week, it is the responsibility normally of a tour manager. And that can, of course, be from an arena to a venue of 100 people, right?
Yeah.
People at both those levels, to essentially fill out a spreadsheet and send it to their rights organization that says, hey, we played here on this night. This is the set list that we played. And of course, where that can become confusing is, you could have 2, 3, 4 support artists as well, who also need to send in as well. So one of the things that we've been doing with these touring artists is going, hey, well, actually, if this is just in the desk, from the moment those doors open and music comes on, be it background music or be it support artists, etc., then that whole piece is just automated for you throughout the entire, you know, duration of the evening. Well, I mean, we've done it on festivals. Always, it's really cool seeing festival data, because, you know, like, you, it starts at like midday and it goes through till kind of 11:30, and it's like background music, artist, background music, DJ, like kind of live performers, the background, and you can really see the different things happening throughout the day. Report it. And of course, what it does is it takes a manualness out of filling out a spreadsheet and sending it that way. We have heard horror stories where, and actually we actually saw this happen in South Africa last year. So I was out at Delicious Festival, which is just like awesome festival. They had somebody from one of the rights organizations, I won't say which, and she asked to be sat side stage. You know, they're cool guys. They're like, yeah, come, right, sit there. And she was literally writing it down. And then, you know, without getting her into trouble, she went off for a drink and you know, to restroom break, whatever she wants to do.
Yeah.
She misses a load of music in between, but she also left her clipboard and her sheet just on the side of the stage. That is the kind of thing that easily, you know, crew in between sets could just sweep that chair, you know, pick up that set list, just chuck it to one side and it's gone. You could lose a day and a half worth of work, you know, collected all that money and then ultimately have no idea who and where to pay for it. Of course, that's not just South Africa. I mean, that is the biggest festivals on the planet are still doing it that way. So you've kind of got all that risk of in the moment, you know, you've then got to hope that that person who's done it can put that set list into their backpack, their handbag, whatever, get it back without getting it wet, without getting it ripped, without losing it. They've then got to go and sit in a laptop. They've got to type it up manually into a spreadsheet, into a CRM system, whatever. The amount of errors that can happen throughout that process is unbelievable. So yeah, so it's kind of cool for us to be able to offer it to touring artists, even big venues. So, you know, we're in some pretty big arenas around the world now where it's just in as part of their tech stack as well. So we can do that as well. Some really fascinating because they don't have amplification. They may have like an orchestra in there. So, you know, you've got to work off the acoustics. There's no mixing desk or anything like that to kind of get into or go off the back of. And then, of course, the DJ one is really interesting because, you know, that's kind of a genre that's not been very well catered for a long time. And then also we know that firsthand that a lot of those DJs, you know, they may have made a mix that morning, so it's not commercially available. So you've got to get all of those bits kind of together from the samples and what's happening. But also, like, their mixes are, that's their IP, it's their whole thing, right? So they don't want anybody recording that. So we talk to them and be like, guys, we're not recording it. Right. We have no audio recording anyway. There is nobody in Odoo that has that. You've got more chance of somebody stood there with a phone recording it than you have with us. Right. So be more worried about that than us. Right. We're here to just get it, get you paid and get the people that you sample paid, which we think is pretty fair. And again, they just love that kind of idea as well.
So I understand the DJ and the playing songs at venues and that. Where I'm still racking my brain around is, why would an artist, if they're on a tour, say, for example, Kylie's on a world tour and she's doing the same set every night.
Yeah.
I know with her tour, she asks the audience to give her a song that she sort of slots in. But why would they have to fill in if it's generally 99% the same set every show?
So some of them, for those kind of shows, they will just submit the same set lists. And actually, we've seen examples of this where, quite frankly, they just cut and paste and they send it through. We've seen some errors in that as well, because like the example, somebody shouted out, hey, can you do this? And the artist has turned and gone, hey, yeah, let's change up the set list. And then nobody's really thought about it, etc. For us, if you're Kylie Minogue, I don't know, you're U2, I'm trying to, you know, Paul McCartney, you're on the biggest stages in the world, right? You've got a pretty slick machine. You've got everything locked down. It's good, right? That's really good. It's kind of those more mid-level that we think that this will be kind of more impactful for as they go as well. But that doesn't mean that the big artists don't want it, because they can go, hey, we just plug this in, right? It's all automated. Yeah, of course, right? Nobody's got to fill in a spreadsheet. Nobody's got to remember or forget to send an email, you know, miss their money, all that kind of stuff. It's just automated for them. And the smart ones, you know what they do? They will monitor the playlist in between as well. So that, you know, that public performance playlist. So if you've got, if they've got like a manager who has multiple artists, they can be super smart and they can make sure A, those artists are being played so people hear them, but also they're driving revenue back to their own business as well, which is kind of a cool way of doing it.
All the concerts I've seen.
Yeah.
And I've been to like close to 90 to 100. The artists will always, not always, I'd say 80% of the time will do a song of one of their favorite artists and sing that, understand that. Yeah. But do you mean to tell me that besides the ticket sales and merch sales that they have at concerts, they still get money for performing their own songs from rights purposes? I never realized this.
Yeah. So it's normally a percentage of the ticket sale. So a percentage of that ticket will go to the rights organization for the live performance of the repertoire. And then, that will kick back to, so if there's the cover, so let's say, because it's easy maths, they play 10 songs, right? But two of those songs are covers. Well, that artist needs to get 80%. Those two covers need to go to the two artists that, you know, that wrote those songs originally as well. So, yeah, so they're almost being, the ticket sale is almost, you know, the majority of it will be for the performance.
Yeah.
A couple of percent, if that, will then be for the essentially the composition, the rights that sit behind it, and then of course all their other bits of income streams that they have on top, you know, VIP and merch, etc. So yes, you've got to make sure that flows through to the right people. And I guess it's probably more relevant where you've got kind of traditional repertoire and artists, so kind of pop acts, where you've got, you know, and I'm trying to give a big pop group at the moment, I guess somebody like Blackpink, because I don't think they write, you know, but that you've got them performing, but then you'll have multiple writers, because I'm sure their management team will have bought off lots of different writers, because they'll have gone out for the right hit songs. So yeah, make sure you got the right one, or what's going on. Or I guess like Ed Sheeran's another good example, because I think, you know, his first two albums he had Jay Gosling as a co-writer, and then he moved to like Johnny McDowell, Steve Mack, etc. So you'd have different co-writers on different albums. So if he's touring a particular album, get it right. If he's doing a kind of, you know, I mean, was there like a greatest hits tour? I think it, you know, Ed's got more than a greatest hits. It is. Maybe one or two albums, right? But even that, you kind of got to get the right mix. And he's the epitome of probably somebody can shout out a song and he can just kind of take it up and do it. So yeah, making sure that those co-writers are kind of compensated correctly is really, really important.
Say, for example, Ed, Kylie, whomever, they've covered a song and it's been a hit on the charts and is now part of their albums and repertoire. Them performing that at the concert compared to them just taking a random song by another artist and performing it as like a nice to for the audience.
This depends how smart and commercial the artist is, right? So if so let's say, I don't know, because he's similar, right? Ed Sheeran playing an Elton John song. In that one, Ed will get his cut. Elton will get his cut. Like, you know, they may have talked about it, but Ed may have just decided to play Tiny Dancer or something during a set. If it's a much smaller artist that you haven't heard of, they can just go and cover it if they want it, and they, you know, do their royalty splits, no problem. There are some permissions that you need to do if it's recorded versus live. But what we've seen is this explosion in the purchase of rights. So where people can go and buy the copyright to a song. So if you're a super, super smart artist and you've got this old song that you love, but isn't really that big, what you do is you go and buy the rights to that song, right? So you go and dig out that very, very tiny songwriter who, you know, probably in my terms hasn't earned a lot of money for a long time. You just go, hey, you want to sell this song to me? I'll give you 10 grand, 20 grand, whatever the number that you want it to be is. And then you go and drive it. You go and drive it hard, like one of your own songs, and you can do it. And, you know, there's great examples about that. You know, the song that Eminem broke, Hi, My Name Is, you know, that's a sample of a guy from like, I think from the 70s. And when they sampled it, you know, the label were like, hey, we need to go find this guy. He was a high school janitor in the US, right? So he definitely isn't anymore, right? That's the reality. So you can have the impact where you can change somebody's life completely. You can be super commercial smart, buy out that copyright, drive it, do something with it. Or yeah, it's just your favorite song. It's already somebody who's a god, an Elton John. You just want to cover it, right? And I think, yeah, I mean, I would guess Elton's the kind of guy that's kind of like, hey, my music's being consumed. It's cool, right? He's not counting the pennies in the bank these days, I'm sure. But I think it's probably more kudos and more great feeling that his music is being shared with another generation.
It's interesting because I at the Kelly Clarkson concert, I remember she sang an Alanis Morissette song. At the Westlife concert, they like did a Kool and the Gang remix. At the Kylie concert, she did like some of the Eminem and Donna Summer. So it's just interesting to understand all these different elements. How much money do you think artists have not been paid over the years because things fell through the cracks?
So Bloomberg calculated this about 4 years ago, and they calculated it, I think it was $2.7 billion a year.
A year, okay.
Yeah, a year. That's what they put out. And that's just because it's fell through the system. Nobody's been able to claim it. And what happens is the societies collect the money, right? And they hold the money. And, you know, they've got kind of two jobs, right? Collect it in, pay it out. That's what they live to do. And look, like, there is no perfect system, right? You know, we're digitizing a clipboard, essentially, in be it live, be it DJ, be it public performance. And we're also, you're never going to be in 100% of venues because you've got to have a cost ratio benefit. Like, that also makes sense as well. But they've always got to hold a little bit back because there could be a copyright claim. There could be a data claim where, say, we're in 10,000 venues in the country, but actually the country has 30,000 venues licensed, and somebody comes in with some really hard evidence that says, hey, this retailer has played me in 300 of their stores 3 times a day for the last year, and I can prove it. Right? How they prove it, I don't know, but that's what they can do. So there's always got to be that little bit back. So you'll hear the term in music black box a lot, which is, yeah, the black box of money that's kind of unallocated. And then what happens with those unallocated funds is typically every 2, 3, 4 years, depending on the country, there's essentially a statute of limitation of how long you can hold that money for. And, you know, and then at that point they go, well, look, it's been 4 years now. What do we do with this cash, right? Because we can't just hold it forever. So what they will then do is they will go back on their previous distributions and go, okay, well, this is how all the other money went in that 4 year period. So let's go and divvy it out completely in exactly the same way to the exact same people. So if you're Taylor Swift, you're Ed Sheeran, you're the biggest artist on the planet, and you already had a large percentage of that share, you get extra money, right? And it could be that it is theirs, like, you know, no issue with that. But the reality is, if this is a small artist that has no idea how to do these claims, kind of work the system, understand what their flow of money is, then all of a sudden it's lost, it's gone to the wrong people, etc. And I think you see two sides. I'm pretty sure, you know, because I said Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran, I'm pretty sure they don't want money that they, you know, isn't theirs, that they're not owed. I think they're pretty decent people from everything you see. And then, you know, the smaller side, I mean, this could be the difference of them making a living or not. Like, quite literally, you know, getting through. So it's really important that, you know, essentially, that, you know, the music industry has gone from this industry of signing records and kind of marketing. You know, that's, you know, I always joke, a record label really is about marketing. It's like, find the hot act, get them in the studio, get something, photo shoot, etc., drive the hype, right? That's what they do. But all of a sudden, what's now underpinning the music industry is data. And at every single point. So, and it should be database decisions. So I'm now being paid correctly because my data is flowing through from this country that's now working with Audu or somebody else. So that's coming through. You know, I'm now going to drop a release based on this song. And when am I going to do it? Is it in the summer? Is it in the winter? Should I drop it on a Tuesday, a Thursday, etc.? Like, when do I kind of get that? What happens? And all those kind of things. So it's becoming more and more important as we go. And then I guess the kind of the final third is you've had these incredible song funds kind of grow. So Hypnosis, everybody will know, Roundhill Music, who've gone out and spent literally billions buying people out of their catalogs. And of course, you know, one of the things that you need to do if you've just spent billions on a catalog is figure out where it's going, right? It will always be buying a house and be like, yeah, I bought my house, but I'm going to rent it out, but I don't quite know where it is. You know, it's okay, I know that in this country, but I don't know what's happening with it. So and you know, some of them are like publicly listed as well, so you know, they've got to call
their revenues, and they've got to call their forecast much more accurately. So if, you know, they bought a catalog and it's bubbling up and they can forecast ahead because they know they're not going to get their money for 9 months, they can go to their shareholders and go, hey, we know that this has grown, you know, exponentially because it was in an advert and this happened. And then we've seen some of the data coming out of Ordu within 15 days that's changing. All of a sudden they can be more in control of what they kind of think is coming down the pipeline as well.
Sure. This is so interesting. It's fascinating to hear this. And you know, it's also the challenge is a lot of the artists, you know, they're just in the creative space, not saying that they're not clever, but they don't know. There's a lot of education pieces that they're not aware of, that they just don't know that they don't need to do all these things to get the money.
It's kind of interesting because I say this a lot, like, it's one of the few industries, it's probably the only industry where you say to people, hey, how'd you get paid? And I reckon 9 out of 10 have no idea. They could not answer that question. You know, you put $1 million on the table and said, okay, cool, draw me three ways that you get paid. And they, concert tickets, okay, yeah, what's the split? T-shirts, okay, what's the split? Okay, royalties, I get royalties, okay. How do they flow? Like, what happens? You're a British artist. What happens if you get paid in South Africa? How does that flow, right? And they don't know. So I think there's an education. I think artists are getting much smarter in commercial because there's more education and things like that out there. And for me, it's for them to really understand and maximize. You know, I talk about it, of course, in startup terms. You know, when you're at the start of your career as an artist, you probably get a pretty bad record deal, right? And a worse split because you've got a break. When you are flying and you're one of the biggest artists on the planet, then you can get a much better deal for yourself. And it's no different to a startup, right? You start in a awful, terrible valuation with a piece of paper saying, I've got this idea. And then, you know, you grow to lots of countries and you have IP and the codec's working and revenue's coming in. You go, okay, great. Now we're worth a lot more money, right? So if I want to raise again, it's a higher valuation, et cetera. So it's kind of, you know, you can see it tied in. I say it all the time, like, the song is a product, right? So yes, I know it's their heart and soul and it's their creative process here. Trust me, I've been there. I did it, right? I was in those moments. But at the same time, it's got a life cycle, realistically. You know, it's evergreens come out every now and then and they last for a very, very long time. But realistically, you know, a single these days on a streaming chart, you can get 3 to 6 months out of it. You've done pretty well. So you've got to kind of get that product out, drive it as an asset, and then, you know, get ready for your next one to keep going and keep making money.
As a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
So much that I could say. I think that if you're an artist, just understand, like, figure out how you're being paid and what's coming from. Like, that is like your number one thing. So think about all of the different ways that your money comes in. I'm driving and helping them get paid with their royalties. And that's an important part of it, because particularly when you go through things like COVID and the world lockdown, that's the place where your only money's coming from. You can't tour. It's pretty hard to sell t-shirts right from your home. So that's really, really important to know what's coming kind of down the line there. And then at all the other points to the business. So if you're touring, are those set lists going in, or do they want an audio visa to go and take with them, right? Like, you know, like, so that's really key. If they're doing covers, make sure the person that you're covering is on that sheet so that they are being paid as well. Because again, this could be life or death for them financially as well. And just maximize everything that you can at every point, you know. So there's other guys doing what we do kind of in social media and UGC in the background as well, which is really important. They do incredible jobs in that space as well. And it's just really understanding, I guess, companies like us and others that are out there going, hey, we're not asking you for money. We're providing it to the society that already take a cut. So we're taking a cut of their cut, essentially, to provide that service. But if you want to see and you want to understand your data, get in touch. Let us know. We'll help, right? We're always here to help.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.